Quick pause here, Joe. I probably have another 10 before I have to go. I've been blindsided. My wife is going to want to is going to want to pick up from the train station, and I thought she was going to be gone longer, but she's got no way to get home.
Sure. Hi, I'm Joe. I'm joined by my good friend Adam, and we're getting reacquainted after 20 years apart. Last episode, we talked about political extremism and who's to blame for all of America's problems. This time around, we'll try to delve deeper into who's to blame for all of America's problems. The topic is the Supreme Court and democracy and majority rule. And let's go back to the tape and see what Adam and I originally said about this topic.
Let's go with the Supreme Court.
Supreme Court it is. Lead it off.
Okay. Well, I'm actually sympathetic to the whole argument that Joe is about to give, which I won't bother to give because why would I help him? Ha! But over time, the law, and in the case of the Constitution, they are very broad laws, or it's a very broad framework, has to be applied differently. Joe used this argument to explain why he is not doing a lot of the things that the Bible says he should do. Because 2,000 years ago, the situation was very different. So he has to apply the laws in ways that he believes make sense for the modern world. Just so, things change quite a bit in 200 years. The reason, and in fact, principles tend to evolve over time. When Jesus said, "Love your neighbor as yourself," this was clearly understood very differently in his time because we've spent 2,000 years plus working out the implications of it. You mean he's my neighbor as well? You mean her too? You mean I should treat women equally? So on and so forth, as opposed to just calling Samaritans dogs. Just so, we have come to understand that equality means giving everybody, votes. And if that involves certain government programs that weren't previously envisioned by the founding fathers, so be it. And I'm good.
All right. So, Supreme Court and the Constitution. The Constitution, I believe, was set up to create a broad framework for governing a very diverse group of people with very diverse viewpoints into binding them into a common group. It was not intended to unify and harmonize the entire nation. Rather, it was intended to provide a framework in which everyone could live together happily without stepping on each other's toes too much. Therefore, it sharply limited the amount that a federal unified government could do and greatly increased the scope of what the several separate state governments could do. Now, this is a framework that some think is outdated and may be outdated in parts and in areas, but the Constitution provided an amendment mechanism to update it for the time. The only requirement for the amendment mechanism is that you be able to get enough agreement throughout the states that this is the proper way to further unify, centralize, or change things in order to move forward. That has proven to be a very high but not insurmountable barrier, as we do have at least 26 amendments to the Constitution today. So my argument would be if the Constitution is too limiting as is, the correct thing to do is to change it, and if you can't get broad enough agreement to change it, then perhaps what you want to do isn't the right thing to do. So Adam, I don't remember what originally prompted this back and forth. I think there was something you'd said on Twitter that I disagreed with, and we knew we had a discussion coming up, so we decided to save it for the discussion, which prompted what we originally debated. But I don't know if that's where we want to start out or go with this episode, or whether you had something slightly different in mind. But I do think at some point we had had a disagreement over whether we should continue to be ruled by strict adherence to the Constitution, or whether we should perhaps be more flexible in how our government operates. So, what's on your mind?
Well, what's amusing about that clip is that both of us were supposed to listen to it before this episode, and neither of us did. But I did take the time before this episode to write down a few notes on my thinking on the process, and they largely, I mean, they largely mirror all of the points I made in that clip. So I can tell you this, that my thinking really hasn't changed in a couple of weeks. And I would, one thing, it's not going to stop us from debating it, but it occurred to me recently that one of the issues here, like probably so many issues at root, is actually one of personality, that you have people who are very comfortable with adhering to the as closely to the law as possible because they are not ones for ambiguity, and you have people who want to consider these other factors. And these are not... neither of these is actually morally wrong, but they are both prone to abuse. I'm going to go ahead, despite saying that I was not going to make your case for you in that clip, and note that you are not wrong, that interpretation does create wiggle room for people to abuse text. That said, I think a lot of our problems come from this fear of... outside influence, and that you really have to take into account these different factors in order to... I don't think you can get away from interpreting the text, from the question of what rights are available to equality before the law and what that means. I think these are issues that necessarily have to be understood in their time. So your word on that.
Yeah, I agree. Interpretation always has to be done when you're dealing with a text that is 200 years old. If nothing else, the meaning of words changes over time, and it requires work to go back and try to determine, in a good faith effort, not what a word means to us today, but what a word meant at the time the Constitution was being drafted. What was the and there are a lot of debates over the best way to interpret the U.S. Constitution. But what did the words mean? And so when the authors used a particular word, what did they likely have in mind when they were using that word? And there's multiple schools of thought of textualism. We should be more bound to the dictionary definition of a word versus originalism. We should be more bound to the original meaning of the word or the original meaning and intent of the author, which is a lot fuzzier to try to determine. So you're right. We're never going to get away from interpretation. And that's always going to be an imperfect enterprise at best. And I think the other thing that comes into mind is people who want to argue, like I do, for a stricter interpretation of the Constitution are often accused of being Constitution worshipers and are often accused of supporting slavery because the original draft of the Constitution allowed for slavery and black votes or black people counted as 3/5 of a citizen for purposes of apportioning representation. And that's often thrown at us. And I'm not saying you will or would in any way do that, but it's enough of an idea that's out there that I want to go ahead and proactively address it. I support the Constitution not out of a specific set of beliefs that, oh my, I really love me some slavery in the Constitution. Boy, it helped in that matter. but more in the matter of we need a measuring stick that we can all agree on and share as a common measuring stick. And the words of the Constitution as amended are what I support and defend. The original draft, the original version of the Constitution prior to amendments had really glaring problems with slavery that we fixed with the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, or at least did our best to fix. Likewise, the original Constitution had some glaring, gaping holes in how we handle the transfer of power in disputed elections, or what do you do if the president has a stroke and is unable to carry out the duties of the office? Do we allow his wife to give orders and pretend that that's coming from her consultations with the president in the sick room? Mm-hmm. Or do we have an actual process for saying, hey, you know what? The president's kind of out of commission. We should put somebody else in charge. And so we had to do amendments to remedy that and to clarify how things were supposed to run. Women didn't have the vote. We fixed that. We first put in that alcohol was going to be something you could make illegal, and then we changed our minds and did another amendment to undo that. So the Constitution has evolved over time and will continue to evolve, I think. There are some amendments I would like to see in this day and age to change the way it works, but the text of the Constitution that we have now as amended, I just have a strong belief that we should stick to that as a common framework for how to run the government, and that the words of the Constitution do mean what they say. And if that leads to an outcome you don't like, and heaven knows there are parts of the Constitution I don't like, you still have to go along with that. You can't just choose to ignore it. And so I think that's where I largely come from, is just that respect for, one, it turns out it's lasted for 200 plus years. This has been a fairly flexible form of government that has worked out well for us. And two, if we're going to have a government, we need to agree on what that government can and can't do. And having a written constitution is as good of a place to start as any.
So I'm going to tack back to something I did say in that clip, which is I find it interesting, not so much in a ha! What do you say to that, Joe? Way than a more neutral, oh, I do find this interesting point, that this is really the opposite attitude you have toward the Bible, that you get all your moral guidance and theory from the Bible, but don't feel bound to its original construction. And it also strikes me as interesting that similar terminology is used, that you want a dead constitution, but you do not want a dead Bible. And the Bible by now would be dead if people could not very, perhaps carelessly reinterpret its verses. In fact, that tends to be the problem I have with a lot of liberal theologians who have their hearts in the right place and want to do the right thing, but I feel really are, don't win a lot of their fight with God's and supposed intentions. Any comment on that?
I think that's a really easy one for me to resolve. We'll let you see if you think I'm just taking an escape hatch that isn't there. I would view the Bible as largely being the story and the documents of a specific group of people interacting with a specific deity. And the various books of the law that are in the Bible, namely Leviticus and Deuteronomy, are the laws that God gave to a particular people at a particular place and time, and those laws were binding on them in that place of time. But those laws weren't necessarily intended to be, or at least I don't believe they were, broadly applicable to all people everywhere. There's a lot in there that is ceremonial behaviors. There's a lot in those two books about clean and unclean, and it wasn't that anyone literally believed you became unclean if you ate the wrong thing or did the wrong thing. It was more a ceremonial, are you the right kind of person doing the right kind of thing? And there were prescribed rituals to go through to move yourself from a state of unclean to a state of clean. So there's a lot in there that's not moral, it's ceremonial. And there's a lot in there that's not moral, it's legal. It's here's a specific crime and here's a specific punishment. And I do believe that was unique to that place and time, rather than saying, here's a crime and this is the punishment that shall apply to all peoples everywhere through all of human history. And so there's a lot of in the Bible that I look at as, yeah, this is a good guide for what was on the mind of God and what kind of things he places importance on, But no, we don't literally need to take an adulterer outside the city limits and stone them until dead. That is not a law that is binding on us. Whereas the Constitution is a different matter. It was an agreement among 13 U.S. colonies that this is how we are going to join together in a political union. This is how we are going to take power and split it up amongst a bunch of different groups of people so that no one becomes too powerful. This is what we're going to allow the government to do. This is what we're not going to allow the government to do. And it was intended to be binding on all Americans, both alive and yet to come. And so here we are, sitting here as Americans. This is the country we live in. This is how we do government in America. But it's not universal. You know, I wouldn't go to a Canadian and say, that violates the 23rd Amendment, or that, you know, you can't do that. They've got a different government. They've got a different set of rules than we do. But if they did try to come here and say, oh, I'm going to do this, I feel I would be well within my rights to say, look, that kind of thing flies in Canada and in France, but here in the U.S., we do things differently. And so I think that's my division between the two. The Bible is a book that is universal to all mankind, but much in it was particular to a specific time and place. And likewise, the Constitution is a specific time and place. And I don't happen to be living in ancient Israel, but I am living in America today.
I think I'd like to, think you make a lot of mistakes in there, but I would like to append to that something that I think that part of the strain of thought that is living constitutionalism, if you will, comes from the Constitution being seen by most Americans in quasi-religious terms. You know, that as it's gotten old and as it is the founding document of this way of life that we all to some degree revere, or a lot of us do, that it has taken on this this greater importance. I think when someone says the Second Amendment guarantees me my rights, for example, of the First Amendment, and I think I do when it comes to the First Amendment to some degree, I'm not simply saying, okay, look at this line in the contract. This says that I'm allowed to say what I want. I mean, I am a full-throated denouncer of people who curb free speech. You know, it's like, no, that is my right. And the Constitution to some degree encourages this. You know, one of the things that makes the U.S. Constitution, in my opinion, not simply a contract, but one of the great milestones of human rights is its universalism, that it declares that, you know, men are endowed by their creator with inalienable rights. Not the Constitution, you know what I'm saying. That in theory, a lot of this does apply to the Chinese and the Russians and the Canadians and so forth. And obviously, no, it's just our document. Nobody else has to abide by it. But you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. I think America, and this is going to sound like a non sequitur, I think America is a much more conservative nation than anybody in the country wants to admit. And I mean that in a small c, lot of inertia, very ossified sense. We have gotten very comfortable with the way things are in this country and have gotten very resistant to changing things just because the way things are is the way things are. There's a lot of areas in just government reforms that I think the U.S. trails the world and trails Europe, in various things, that have, say, been privatized in Europe, but were hugely resistant to privatizing in the U.S. for, as far as I can tell, no good reason except for, well, that's the way we've been doing it for the last 200 years. What do you mean we should change? And I think the Constitution comes into that in too great, honestly, too great of a respect for the Constitution. This is the words that are in it. What do you mean proposing a constitutional amendment? You can't change the Constitution. That's dangerous. Whereas I think the Constitution is meant to be a living document, but it's meant to be a living document that really pushes for national unity. It's meant to be a document that, yes, we can change the rules that the country operates under. There just needs to be widespread agreement, because everybody's going to be forced to live under this. There needs to be really, really widespread agreement over it before we do it. It shouldn't just be a majority of people changing the rules on almost a whim. And so it's hard to amend the Constitution, but in some ways I think it's supposed to be easier than it is, because I think a lot of people hear the words constitutional amendment and they almost treat it more seriously than it deserves to be treated. Whereas I think it's, hey, if you think the Electoral College is a bad idea, let's talk about how we replace it and how we unwind it. You know, in some ways, I like the Electoral College. In some ways, I think the Electoral College is getting a bit creaky. And even if we try to keep the spirit of it, perhaps we need to change the actual operation of it. But that's something we should be able to have a conversation about and to put into an amendment and say, okay, we've all agreed, or the vast majority of us have agreed, this is how we should do federal presidential elections. Let's write it down and stick it in there. And it should be not quite routine. You know, I don't think we should be like some of these nations that have 200, 300 amendments to their constitution. I think that might be moving a little bit too fast. Mm. But it should be a living document, you know, to your point. It should be a living document that changes over time. I just think the way we should do it is not through some vague understanding that certain stuff doesn't apply anymore, but it should just, we should talk about it, we should come to an agreement, and we should write it down.
It's tempting to talk about the Electoral College, maybe if we have a little time at the end, but let's discuss then what the actual claims are of living constitutionalists, because to some degree I think they are very much mistranslated. What's the word I'm looking for here?
Misunderstood,
or, you know, wrongly presented by the right.
Misrepresented.
Yes, there we have it. Living constitutionalists, and I'm going to use this from a very well-known source. This is Wikipedia. It's short and sweet. Suggest that broad ideals such as liberty and equal protection were included in the Constitution precisely because they are timeless due to their inherently dynamic nature. Liberty in 1791, it is argued, was never thought to be the same as liberty in 1591 or 1991, but was rather seen as a principle transcending the recognized rights of that day and age. So the thing is, that when we passed the women's suffrage, the thing was that an argument could easily be made, and I think that equal protection was already granted in 1868. And so it's there, it's in the Constitution, and once you see that mistake, why not correct for it? I mean, because if those words have meaning. And I think in that particular case, also, that it is not that we are misinterpreting, the words equal protection in that document. If anything, the people who lived back then were misinterpreting, willfully, equal protection. You know, but of course we meme white people. You know, there's a whole lot of, I mean, that's their problem, not ours, as far as I'm concerned. That's an example of mankind's evolution. So what would you say to that?
I agree with almost all of that, except for the assumption that we should just be able to correct it without updating the words as written.
How would you update those words, though? Equal protection makes total sense to me. I might say that today.
Yeah, but there's specific language in Article 1, which is the legislative branch, and Section 2, the House of Representatives shall be composed of members chosen every second year by the people of the several states, and the electors in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislature. You know, we've got actual words that say this is who is eligible to vote,
And I'm scrolling down to Amendment 19, Women's Right to Vote. So we originally, the words we had written down was essentially who is eligible to vote is up to each state. And whatever qualifications that state has set for whichever state house has more people in it, that's the qualifications for federal electors. And so if a state says, hey, women can't vote, well, the words in the Constitution are, okay, women can't vote because they're not allowed to vote for this house. And so at some point you need to update the actual words to say, as Amendment 19 does, the right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. And there you go. It's that simple. We've updated the words to say, okay, you can set whatever qualifications you want for voting, but sex cannot be one of them. Other than that, the words still stand, but we're adding this. Now we all agree sex cannot be one of those limiting factors. And so that's what I mean when I say, yes, equal rights and equal rights might imply a certain thing, but I think you need to write it down to have true societal agreement. Otherwise, you risk having one group of people say, oh, equal rights means this. And maybe 30% of the country believes that, 70% doesn't. And if you're just going to have a judge somewhere say, yep, I agree with the 30%, I agree with the minority, this is the way things should be, you have then a very angry 70% majority who is not bought in, who has not agreed, who has no stake in the process, no skin in the game. And I think that's what you lose by not going through an amendment process. And I think it sets the dangerous precedent that if you can get the right person in the right courthouse at the right time, you can do whatever you want, whether or not the majority agrees. And I think in a lot of cases, what the majority wants in this country, whether now or in the past, has not necessarily been, or sorry, what maybe a minority wants is not necessarily a great thing. You know, last episode, we were just talking about white nationalists and white supremacists and how they're a very small minority in the country. Do we want to open it up where if we manage to get some in-the-closet white nationalist on a judicial bench that he or she can say this is what the law shall be and suddenly put that on everybody without broad agreement? I don't think so.
It occurs to me as I scan my notes that I have, and I think this may just be a personal dynamic between us, but that I tend to be your interlocutor or interrogator, rather. Do you have any actual questions on your list, or are we just having a good conversation here? Are we happy?
I think we're mostly having a good conversation. I mean, to me, it really is a simple matter of let's just write it down. I think my question to you would be, as I was thinking over this topic, if we're going to start saying we can either ignore or reinterpret, and maybe I should just stop there and say, how far are you willing to go in living constitution? Is it just a matter for you of, it says equal rights, men can vote, women can't, so equal rights means women should be able to vote. Just that reinterpretation line, or would you say, you know what, if there's a prohibition that was, it's now outdated, it doesn't really apply, we should just be free to ignore that. Are you also more on the side of, we should be able to ignore what doesn't fit?
Well, man, I do see the dangers of overinterpretation. I think the Commerce Clause, for example, is certainly open to a lot of gets a lot of abuse. And I think we do, by the way, kind of ignore parts of the Constitution already. For example, being hung for treason, that doesn't really happen anymore. I have a hard time imagining it doing so. I do think that, the suffrage was maybe a bad example in which I shot myself in the foot, but there are a number of unexplicated parts of the Constitution that do require consideration. For example, what is cruel and unusual punishment now? What is, well, I'll just go with that one because that's what's come to my mind. So no, I don't want to ignore the Constitution. And to be honest, if we were chalking up our scores and columns here, I think we both feel like we've done better in some episodes against the other person than we have in others, then I'd probably put this one in your court because I'm not nearly as knowledgeable as you about the Supreme Court. I know to some degree it's not a simple interpretation of those words. I mean, you have the tradition that they're supposed to involve. It's almost like reading the Torah. First you read the verse, and then you're supposed to read the commentary on that, and then you're supposed to make a decision in light of that. I mean, this is unavoidable, and I'm not familiar with that commentary. So I don't press this issue hard. And there is a very good argument to make that bending the Constitution to account for the modern age makes it harder to change it. That, you know, if you just let things get bad, then people will want to change the Constitution instead of argue about what it means. Although that may not take enough account of human nature. So I think I would like to think that my position on how much interpretation is open or is reasonable is fairly clear, but I'm not at all honestly opposed to the way that you suggest perceiving it.
Yeah, I'm trying in this conversation to keep myself from just going on a 30-minute lecture of schools of constitutional interpretation and judicial engagement versus judicial activism, which I do think is worth touching on. So I'm going to go there a little bit, but I'm going to try not to ramble. In the 90s, conservatives really liked to attack what they call activist judges, who would be 9 black-robed legislators sitting on the judicial bench who would look at the law that came before them and then rewrite it to suit their whims and make the federal law, make the policy of the nation be whatever they wanted it to be by inventing penumbras emanating from auras emanating from the text of the Constitution. And I do think there's a danger in that. I think there's a danger in being able to say, look, I can look at these particular words, and if I twist myself around 90 degrees, hold up a prism, and then tilt that 60 degrees into the ether, I can see a clear definition of what we should do in this case. I think there's a real danger to doing that. And what I've seen the Institute for Justice, which is a libertarian public interest law firm that I happen to support, what I see them arguing for today is not judicial activism, but judicial engagement. The idea that judges should sit on the bench and they should listen to the case. And often, very, very, very often, judges have a tendency to defer to the government. If a city government said something, or a state government said something, or the federal government said something and said, we need this law because of X, judges have a pronounced tendency to sit there on the bench and goes, well, Congress said it, must be true, and just move on and allow whatever law or policy to stand without any examination of whether that justification is valid, whether it stands up, whether it's right. And so what the Institute for Justice pushes for is judicial engagement, for judges to push back and say, okay, you've said that's why we need this particular law, or that's why this particular law is constitutional. But let's actually look into the details of that. Let's see if that actually makes sense. Let's look at the historical record. Let's look at the meaning of the words in the text and see if your rationale makes any sense at all, or if you're just inventing justifications to seize power. And so if, in terms of how should we view the Constitution, that's really how I want to see it being viewed. I think governments, the natural tendency of government is to grow and is to claim more powers for itself. And if that's a legitimate power, fine. I might fight against it politically, but I can't pull the Constitution onto my side. But I at least want judges who are sitting and who are reading the Constitution and who are saying, almost as you said, well, is this a matter for equal protection of the laws? is this an area where we are perverting equal protection rather than upholding it? Is your justification for denying women the right to vote, is your justification a good one? Or in fact, should women have the right to vote because we say that everybody is equal under the law? And then you get into some really interesting conversations about whether everybody really means everybody, because when they wrote the Constitution, did they mean everybody? And there's some very diverse, even on the right, schools of constitutional interpretation. Everybody accuses the late Justice Scalia and the current Justice Thomas of being mirror images of each other. But in fact, this was one area where they had a fair amount of disagreement. Justice Scalia believed more strongly in what was the original meaning and intent of the people who wrote the Constitution. And Justice Thomas is a much stricter, who cares what they meant? They wrote down a word. What does that word mean? And let's go according to the definition of the word that they wrote down without trying to get into means and motives. So I want the Constitution to be a living document in the sense that we've got engaged judges who are pushing back on laws and examining really what's going on with the law and whether that really fits in with the Constitution or not. And I want judges who strike down more laws as this is an abrogation of equal protection, or this is an abrogation of due process. And the idea of due process, for listeners who are not familiar with constitutional law and interpretation, is before you can throw someone into prison, or before you can take someone's property or money, you have to go through an actual legal process. You have to arrest them. You have to charge them with an actual crime that is actually on the books with a definite standard of evidence and with a definite standard of what makes what they did illegal. And then you have to go into court and you have to lay out all of the facts and you have to prove that they are guilty of infringing the law and that the punishment you are proposing is the punishment defined in the law. Then and only then can you throw them into prison or fine them or whatever. That is due process of law. And so I want more judges looking into, hey, when you took that guy's money at the airport, did you, in fact, go through due process of law, or did you just make some kind of vague statement about how he was a drug dealer and you were going to seize his cash? Because if you did, that can't stand. You can't do that. Mm. And so I want the Constitution to be living. I want people to be engaged with it. I just want, if there's a disagreement, if there's really strong national disagreement about whether it means A or whether it means B, we've got to hash that out in a political process rather than just letting justices vote and decide what it is for us.
Okay. Well, I think we've made our points here. Well, a good conversation as always, Joe, and look forward to the next.
I enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
If you liked the show, help new listeners find it by listening to Reacquainted and rating it in Apple Podcasts. Go into Apple Podcasts, subscribe to Reacquainted, and give it a rating. You can also see announcements for new shows, episodes, and upcoming live streams by following at FromVoxDuo on Twitter. That's at FromVoxDuo. Adam is on Twitter. His handle is at AdamVolle. That's Adam VOLLE. Joe blogs at MinorThoughts.com, and he's on Twitter as well, at JMartinDF.